Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Florida's Gulf Coast is bracing for Hurricane Milton, even as cleanup continues from Hurricane Helene. The back-to-back hurricanes have stretched the Federal Emergency Management Agency. But it's not the only disaster they're deployed to. FEMA is on the ground for a landslide in Vermont, tornadoes in Kansas, a watch fire in Arizona, tropical storm that hit New York, disasters that were all declared in just the last few weeks. It's all culminated in the fact that FEMA is short on money, workers, all while battling misinformation about the kind of relief they offer. Christopher Flavelle is a climate reporter for the New York Times. He's been covering FEMA's real challenges and the ones being made up on the internet. Welcome back to All Sides, Christopher.
Hi, great to be with you.
So you reported that FEMA's staffing levels are low. Just 9% of its personnel is available to respond to hurricanes or other disasters. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, so FEMA has a really highly trained workforce. They call it their incident management workforce. These are the staff who are sort of first line of defense, if you will, to deploy during and after disasters. They put out a report every morning showing what share of those workers remains available to deploy to some new disaster. I try to watch it. I cover FEMA. And yesterday I noticed that for the first time in memory, it had fallen below 10%. What that means is the overwhelming majority of the FEMA staff who are most trained and prepared to do this work are already in the field dealing with some of these disasters.
But FEMA is sounding a reassuring tone. They're saying, don't worry about this. We're prepared for it.
They are very much sounding that tone. It's a bit hard to know. Their response is, we've got the ability to pull people from other parts of the federal government. They can make local hires. They can bring in contractors. One catch from my perspective is it's not clear if the amount of training those people have really is commensurate with what FEMA staff would have. FEMA's been here before. In 2017, the U.S. was hit by a series of really bad storms, and FEMA was stretched very thin at that point as well. And one of the knocks on FEMA during that period from independent investigators was that they really got to a point where they were sending people who weren't ready for the jobs because they had no choice. So we won't know until months from now just how well FEMA has managed this in terms of finding staff that can play these roles. They are sounding a reassuring tone, but by their own internal metrics, it's a pretty dire situation.
This Hurricane Helene, which ripped through several states, including Florida and most devastatingly North Carolina, also came with its own storm of misinformation. People on social media have falsely claimed that FEMA itself was confiscating or bulldozing land for profit. That is not true, correct?
Yeah, it almost feels silly to state that isn't true. But here we are, right? It's 2024, so yes, we are compelled to note that is not the case.
There's also been misinformation about money being offered to victims of Hurricane Helene, particularly around this initial $750 payment.
Yeah, so FEMA has been pushing this. It's one of their reforms, making early, fast money more easily available, this $750 payment. It's their goal with this is to make sure disaster survivors have money fast. It is not a loan. I've seen people claiming it's a loan and you have to pay it back. And if you don't pay it back, FEMA can confiscate your property. None of this makes sense, right? It's not a loan. It's a grant. And it is not at all the sum total of FEMA aid. It's sort of the beginning payment. So people, it's amazing, frankly, the degree to which that one payment has been misunderstood or misrepresented.
So yeah, essentially it's the, oh my gosh, I don't have clothes or shoes. Here is money to get clothing, shoes, some initial food, maybe a place to stay for a night. And then the money to replace a house, to fix other losses, those require more documentation, more verification, essentially just more time.
Exactly. There's a big process. You have to apply for those programs. FEMA, if it's for home repairs, FEMA will send an inspector. They'll send you an initial estimate. So it takes a long time. And I think FEMA has been beaten up about how long those programs take. So was trying to also provide money quickly, and it's become fodder for this sort of online disinformation campaign.
Yeah, and you can have a fair criticism about how long it takes to get through that approval process, but obviously the flip side of it is if they're going to cut you a $30,000 check, they want to make sure you actually lost a home or a car or needed mass structural repairs because, I mean, I hate to say it, but someone could lie.
And there's FEMA faces great pressure from two directions, right? Great pressure from disaster survivors to move money quickly, and also great pressure from Congress to be really thorough and do everything they can to cut down on waste, fraud, and abuse. So they're, I've covered this for a decade at this point. They are doing a tough job in terms of threading those two competing pressures, and really, almost by definition, they will never make everyone happy.
I wonder if you think the misinformation is getting worse, because there's a professor of emergency management, Samantha Montano, who said that she's been doing disaster work for 20 years and cannot think of another acute disaster where there has been this much in misinformation. Do you think this is worse than, what you saw maybe a few years ago with Ian or any other disaster in recent history?
I don't know how you would measure it, but qualitatively, 100%. It's getting worse. It seems to be a trajectory. I don't recall any event with this level of just lies floating around. I think the interesting question is why it's getting worse, and that's a hard one to answer. But certainly, based on what I see, something has been shifting.
Climate-related disinformation also tends to peak after natural disasters. I've even seen, on the fringes, this idea that somehow Helene was created by the government, which is, it is not true.
It would be astounding if the government had the capacity to create a hurricane. Yes, again, here we are, 2024, forced to state that the government did not create a hurricane, but that's correct. It did not.
Yeah, their cloud seeding is a complicated science. It's questionably effective, but right, so just they struggle to even get it to rain where they might want it to rain on a small parcel of land.
Yeah, I mean, well, the conversation. Cloud seeding is fascinating. In general, cloud seeding can increase the likelihood of rain somewhat and the amount of rain somewhat, but it is not a technology. Yeah, it feels weird even saying this. It is not a technology for creating hurricanes. I can't be any more straightforward than that.
Yeah, I know. The other claim is that disaster relief funds are being diverted to undocumented immigrants. Now, I will say FEMA is housed within the Department of Homeland Security, and the Department of Homeland Security does have pots of money that deal with immigrants, but Congress allocates that money, right? Like, the Department of Homeland Security can't take money from the undocumented immigrant pot and give it to FEMA. Well, I mean, they could, the Department of Homeland Security can't do that. Congress could do that.
Yeah, it's worth just taking a quick beat on this because this is so prevalent, this
Yeah.
misunderstanding. FEMA has this device called a disaster relief fund. It's sort of a standing pot of money continually replenished by Congress as needed. So FEMA has the funding for dealing with these disasters, which sort of by definition you can't plan for, right? That is a very directed and purposeful fund. It is not there to be used for other purposes. So this idea that FEMA's money for disasters is being sort of diverted or funneled away to other uses, it's not how the system is built. And it of all the things you might criticize FEMA for, that's really not one of them.
Yeah, it's a literal rainy day fund.
Yes, that's a great way of thinking about it.
And Congress could come and give FEMA more money. And I know FEMA may be asking for that, but House Speaker Mike Johnson has declined to bring the U.S. House back before the election to give FEMA more money.
Yeah, just in the time I've been covering this, I've always had the view on this that Congress will replenish that fund when it needs to. That feels like a less certain thing these days, but I really think the question of money probably isn't FEMA's biggest challenge right now. Congress can replenish that fund whenever it wants to. And history suggests that when it really gets low, that will happen again.
So is it kind of like every couple of months we have that fiscal cliff? We're going to have a government shutdown. We need more money to run the government. And then at the 11th hour, we get more money to run the government.
It's a bit like that. I mean, shutdowns, I think, probably are more nail biters because there's real competing interest there. But with I mean, no one wins if FEMA runs out of money to help disaster victims, right? So I don't think this country's politics are yet bad enough that somebody would really advocate for that, but you never know.
I want to talk a little bit about Hurricane Milton because, when you look at the Gulf Coast of Florida, they are recovering from Hurricane Helene just a few weeks ago. People have big debris piles still outside of their houses, and now they're bracing to be hit again.
Yeah, look, I mean, the one thing Florida has going for it is state and local emergency managers have lots of experience, right? That's not a great thing to brag about, but they know what they're doing. So there's reason to think that they will handle this well. FEMA is very aware of what's going on. They'll help where they can. I'd like to think that residents of coastal Florida know what's going on, though it's tough because lots of people move to Florida every year. So, people may not take these warnings seriously, especially if they're new transplants to Florida. But in general, Florida faces this storm with a pretty good set of tools to deal with it. But you're right, when you get, if it's a Cat 4 storm hitting Tampa Bay directly, that's pretty serious. So, I echo the point everyone makes here, which is I hope people wind up heeding orders or encouragements to evacuate when they should.
Yeah, I have a question for those of us not in the eye of the storm. How do you have suggestions for folks on how they can be more media literate when, especially when they're, flicking through social media or TikTok? How do you make sure that what you're hearing is real? Because sometimes the misinformation can sound legitimate.
Well, I'm compelled to respond by saying everyone should have a subscription to the New York Times, right? And there's so many great media outlets in this country, and it's not hard to find one and to sign up and get your news from a trusted source. If you want to get government news that's accurate, NOAA and the National Hurricane Center have great updates on Twitter. FEMA puts out great information on Twitter. So I guess I'd urge everyone to follow the same rule journalists follow, which is go to the source. If you're not sure how the person you're reading or listening to got their information, just ignore them and go straight to the source or use a trusted journalism outlet. It sounds so simple because I think it really is.
Yeah, FEMA will definitely have a lot of information on its social media, on its websites, even governors of states. The governor of North Carolina has been pretty out front on what is and isn't happening in his state, on the kind of response that the federal government has given. And it's coming straight from the governor's mouth.
Yeah, I mean, it's people. I think people are smart and savvy, and they can tell if something feels weird. Go to the source, check the governor's social media feeds, check FEMA's social media feeds, read the New York Times and other trusted outlets, and just if something sounds weird, like I'm like these social media posts that you hear about what FEMA's doing, and you just think, how could anyone believe this? If it seems unbelievable, probably take a second. Maybe it's not true.
Yeah, my rule of thumb is if it incites a visceral reaction of rage, of anger, if it creates a feeling inside you, a really deep feeling, I don't know why, but that's like my spidey sense tingles, and I'm like, maybe that was written that way for a reason.
Yeah, if you read some words that sound like someone was shouting them, probably they're not true.
That was Christopher Flavelle, a climate reporter for the New York Times. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, how Ohio State is becoming a training facility for future astronauts. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides, where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. I'm your host, Anna Staver. John Horak has spent his career working to advance human spaceflight. He's worked with NASA, different space companies, and now he's here at Ohio State, where he's the Neil Armstrong Chair in Aerospace Policy. Welcome to All Sides, Professor Horak.
Thanks for having me. Please call me John.
Okay. John, there are quite a few space-related developments happening at the university, and I'm glad you're here to walk us through all of them. So let's start with 2022, when Ohio State partnered with two private space companies, NanoRacks and Voyager Space, to open a research facility. How did this partnership come about?
So the partnership between Voyager and NanoRacks, NanoRacks is now a part of Voyager, came about through Ohio State's participation as the lead university on a proposal that was put to NASA for ideas to follow the International Space Station with privately owned, commercially operated space stations that would work in low Earth orbit. That station is called Starlab. That award was made in December of 2022, and on that proposal, Ohio State was honored to be the lead university in that partnership, which continues a vibrant growth today.
So how is that gearing up? Because I understand Starlab won't open until 2028. So what does that process look like now?
Yeah, so you have to sort of prepare for that launch day and be ready to go when that launch comes in late 2028. So we have several jobs associated with that. One, of course, we're a university. So workforce development, preparing the workforce of the future, getting students engaged in space research and things that will happen. We're also interested in helping the organization innovate, start new companies, new products and services. We're contributing certain technical engineering and scientific expertise to the growth of and the development of the space station, growing the research community, and then hosting something called the George Washington Carver Science Park, which is the ground infrastructure and sort of the ecosystem here for research that will support what's going on the International Space, on the Starlab after the International Space Station.
So Starlab will be a commercial space station. Will regular people, I mean, I guess if you have enough money, be able to go there? How is that going to function?
So much like NASA has done with the ability to send cargo to the International Space Station, that has been now over maybe 20 years been working on a commercial basis with companies like Orbital ATK, which is now Northrop Grumman, or SpaceX. We now send people to the International Space Station on a commercial basis. And so this playbook, if you will, this play will be run for the third time and to enable NASA to focus on things like going to the moon and Mars. And we will allow privately owned, commercially operated space stations to work in low Earth orbit and solve NASA and the nation's research needs in that modality.
So it's a public-private partnership for this, but it will still be NASA astronauts going.
Well, NASA astronauts, I expect that we will see astronauts from other sovereign nations. For example, pick a country, Australia, for example. They don't have launch vehicles and spacecraft, but they may wish to purchase a six-month mission on board, and, as well as commercial research and perhaps tourism as well, yes.
So you're essentially helping to free up NASA for its mission to Mars.
Yeah, in an environment where, you know, NASA's budget's not going to double or triple, it's unlikely to grow. Nobody's budget is that blessed. In order to do new things, you have to find ways. I don't want to say to offload, but how to innovate and do them in a different modality. So the opportunity to move some of the work that we're doing in low Earth orbit research to a commercial basis allows NASA then to use those funds to do the things that it's chartered to do.
Let's talk a little bit about the George Washington Carver Science Park. So where's it going to be located? What's its mission?
Yeah, so the George Washington Carver Science Park is, again, with Ohio State and Voyager Space, to develop a ground-based ecosystem for research to support what goes on in low Earth orbit. And not just for people that research stars and planets and galaxies and quasars, but material science, biotechnology, human health, food and agriculture will be an important part of the research domain. And so much like I tell my mom, I say, hey, you know, if you go see the Phantom of the Opera at the Majestic on Broadway, The show is great. The costumes are perfect. The singing is amazing. The blocking is spectacular. But what you don't see is where did they build the set and where did they rehearse the music and where did they sell the tickets? All of that back office infrastructure that's needed to support the show, much like what you see in space. You get to the ISS or you get into space, you don't want to have, you want to have planned that out and you want to have worked out all the kinks on the ground and then have a place on the ground where you extract the value from the research to create social, economic, educational, and quality of life outcomes. That'll be located at the north side of the Ohio State University Airport along Route 161. Ohio State retains ownership of the land, and we will be building the science park there on the north side of the runways.
Will there be any component that's open to the public? Will we be able to kind of like tour and see what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. I tease my boss, Peter Moeller, and others. I say, you know, the thing we need to do is make sure the parking lot is built enough, big enough to handle all the school buses that will come. And one of the beauties of NASA is that it's an amazing organization. You know, you see the logo on student shirts everywhere. But much of what they do is behind a large gate, and it can be very, very hard to get there. So one of the things that we're working very hard to do is to use the George Washington Carver Science Park as a place where people of all ages, sizes, interests, and domains can come and experience what it's like and actually participate to the greatest extent practical in what goes on in space.
Sort of inspiring the next generation.
Without a doubt. And sometimes inspiring the current generation as well. There's nothing more inspirational than to sit in your backyard and watch the International Space Station fly over and realize, you know, that on many nights, the brightest thing in the sky is the product of the human mind and the work of human hands.
Oh, my goodness. That is a really, I've never thought of it that way.
Yeah, and then you see, you know, you see it fly over. You can get an app, and it'll send you a text, and you look up, and you're like, wow, there's 7 or 8 people up there, and I know a couple of them, or I've had a chance to meet a couple of them, and you wave, and they don't wave back. I don't know why they're not quite so interested in waving back.
Okay. I don't know that we have a telescope powerful enough to see them wave back.
Exactly, exactly.
So this Science Park will also serve as a training ground for potential astronauts.
Yeah, so the way I would look at that is that, you know, you never, ever, ever go to space and do something for the first time, much like I mentioned, Phantom of the Opera at the Majestic, there's a bunch of rehearsals that go on. And so when you're operating a payload or doing a science experiment, you need to train. And much of that science training and experiment training, will be done here as a part of the development of the experiment so that we understand what's the best way to operate that, what's the best way to turn it on, turn it off, and analyze and collect data while you're up in space.
That makes sense. And I love the acting analogy because you're right. An actor wouldn't go on stage having only read the script once.
Exactly right. Yes. You can spend 10 to 100 times as much time on the ground preparing as you actually do when you're in space. I don't know the exact data, for example, for a spacewalk. But, you know, something as high risk, high consequence to failure as something like that, you absolutely have to practice that, for example, in the pool in Texas. And that's why the astronauts spend so much time in training, because the consequences for failure on orbit are high. It's a high consequence environment, costs a lot of money, and the outcomes are important as well. I mean, space has just become a part of our everyday life.
I also understand that the Science Park will conduct parallel research on the ground in space. Is that just seeing how things react differently?
Well, certainly. Any good science experiment, to the best you can do it, has sort of a control sample and then the experiment itself. And so let's say I take a plant to space, right? I'm trying to figure out, you know, how do plants sense gravity. I want to control that experiment by doing the same thing on the ground at the same time in the greatest similar way possible, so that I know the differences that I'm seeing are a function of having flown to space and not something else that happened to work its way into the experiment.
While we're on the topic of plants, I want to move to food. NASA recently held its Deep Space Food Challenge at Ohio State. What was that? Because I immediately think of that, like, terrible, chalky space ice cream.
Yeah, well, two things I'm good at. One is space, hopefully, because I've spent my career there, and the other is eating, because I've been doing it my whole life. So the intersection of food and space is pretty amazing. And of course, feeding astronauts on deep space missions, you know, is a challenge. So NASA has held this program called the Centennial Challenges Program, one of which was the Deep Space Food Challenge. It's open innovation trying to get companies to figure out how do we create technology and systems to feed astronauts in deep space. So over several years, the finals were then held down to four companies that came here. We put them in the food production lab here at Ohio State, and we hired four students called Simunauts to actually run the experiments. Because, you know, the designer of the car you drive is not the person driving you around. You have to be able to operate that. And so the students acted as Simunauts. They were absolutely amazing. You can type in Simunaut into Google and read all about them. And this was a day and a half, both part celebration, part technology exposition. And then at the end, NASA awarded about $1 million in prize money to several different companies, the finalists who were here, to help push the noodle, so to speak, on how to feed astronauts in deep space.
I love it. So it sounds like we have come a long way from the chalky space ice cream we all bought as kids.
Yeah, I think if you're going to go get you and I are going to spend, let's say, 6 months going to Mars or whatever it is, we want to do something other than eat out of a toothpaste tube.
Ugh.
And food is such a cultural and emotional thing, right? I mean, we gather around the table not just because it nourishes our body, but it nourishes our mind, it nourishes our well-being. It's important for our behavioral health, aroma, taste, all of these things can change in space. And so it's really important to pay attention not only to how we just give you the right amount of calories, but also the right amount of nutrition, and make that something that you actually want to eat and that it's enjoyable to share with your crewmates.
Especially, I mean, if you think about a mission to the moon and back, I mean, it could be a couple of weeks, right?
Yeah.
A mission to Mars and back could be a couple of years.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a totally
right.
different calculation.
Yeah, and it's sort of the extreme version of deep backpacking into the wilderness, because right now you have to take everything with you. And we don't have right now the capacity to grow on a spacecraft all the food that would be needed to sustain human life all the way out and all the way back, right? You have to come back too, hopefully. So this idea that we can innovate around food concepts, how to grow more nutritious food, even if it's just a supplement to the canned diet, so to speak, that you would take, it's an important part of emerging technology. And the intersection between agriculture, food, and space is a really, really vibrant place to do really interesting research and create a lot of interesting and economically important outcomes for us here on Earth. So there's ag for space, but there's also space for ag.
That's fascinating, actually. If somebody like grew up on a farm in Ohio, then they could take that skill, come to Ohio State, and learn how to grow for Mars.
So, in fact, there are any number of students who are both not from a farm or from a farm. Some of them are headed over to Italy next week to present some of their agriculture space research at an international conference. If you want to grow plants in space, if you want to use space to learn about how to grow plants better, we have a place for you. Please send me an email or give us a call.
That sounds incredible, actually. It's such a fun thing to spend your life working on.
Yeah, I mean, we all like to eat, right? So kind of the intersection of food and space is great.
I think it's also like what you said about food being more than just nourishment for our bodies, that if you're going to spend 2 years traveling to Mars or 2 years on this mission, there's a mental health component there,
yeah.
One that NASA is really looking into. And having food that is good, that is nourishing,
yeah.
That'll be such a large component of that mental health.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that in many ways we can figure out how to mitigate some of the physical health effects that occur when you go to space. And it's not really a kind thing to do to your body. But behavioral health is really, really important. And NASA for a long time has placed a strong emphasis on picking a crew, on the compatibility. How do they solve problems? How do they get along? How do they communicate? When you go to space for a year, and if you know on the ISS, International Space Station, you can look out the window, you can call home, you're kind of coming back at some point. You might get stuck up there a little bit longer than had been planned.
I was going to say, that's been in the news recently,
yeah,
I think.
It's not a bad thing, though, if you're an astronaut to get stuck in space. It's sort of like being a Francophile and getting stuck in France. You know, you're sort of really happy about it in some ways. But Mars is very different, as you said. And so paying attention to how we keep a sound mind in a sound body is really important. And food, the environment, we have a group of students here in the architecture school who are in a studio class trying to design your personal accommodations, where you eat, you sleep. Yeah, because that's really important. Like if you know, you and I get on each other's nerves, I need to go away for a while, or you need to go away for a while. Where do I go to relax and recharge, right? This is very, very important.
So there's something about yanking a curtain closed that doesn't have the same dramatic effect.
Exactly right. And that's part of the reason that Hilton Hotels is a part of the Starlab partnership, because they are helping design the astronaut accommodations, because we need to create a livable space where people can be functional, where they can be comfortable, feel like they're cared for and challenged, and hopefully translate some of that learning from space back to places on the ground.
Yeah, when I think of space travel, I mean, you think of maybe like Star Trek, and we may be generations away from that kind of spacecraft where you can move around, where there are bars and private quarters.
Yeah, exactly. I think Star Trek is definitely the realm of science fiction. The space station is perhaps much more like a long-duration camping trip in a metal shell with a lot of technology around you. But yeah, it's I'd go in a minute if I had a chance, for sure.
It's much more like Wild West Frontier than four-star resort.
Yeah, but with the best view you've ever seen in your whole life. I mean, to look down on the planet, I have not had the opportunity, but my friends that have flown say it literally will rewire your brain. You begin to see humanity as a planetary species, and they kind of realize there's no planet B. So we sort of have to take care of the one we got. We have to figure it out instead of fight it out. We got to learn to get along, and we got to learn to share our resources. All the things that you learned in kindergarten, right? We have to learn on a planet-wide scale.
Yeah, I guess it really would. I don't know. I've obviously never seen the Earth from space, but I imagine you just have to feel so small.
Yeah, I think Neil Armstrong said, you know, that when he stood on the moon, he didn't feel big. He felt very, very tiny. You know, you can actually stand on the moon and block out the Earth with your thumb, the whole planet, right? And then there's this picture that was taken by the Voyager spacecraft, the pale blue dot that Carl Sagan had taken, where you sort of look and you see this little grainy blue dot in the blackness of space, and you realize that every person you've ever read about, every person that's ever fallen in love, or every person that's ever had a heartbreak, or every story, it's all taken place on that pale blue dot, and that's the gift we've been given. So we need to take good care of it and take good care of each other.
So what's the future of the Space Lab here? What comes next?
Yeah, so what we'll be doing, we're working with in two tracks. One is that we're actually working to build the spaceship itself, the Starlab spaceship, and to make sure that the research pipeline is built up across multiple disciplines, from neurology to archaeology and from astrophysics to anthropology. And then the second thing is the development of the space park at the north side of the airport. So we're working closely with Voyager Space now. We have done the first 10 acres have been leased by Voyager, and we're working on developing the site plan and the construction of the facilities that will house the George Washington Carver Science Park and many other space-related activities as well. So in the next year or so, I think you'll start to see some dirt being turned. You'll see some physical signs of growth. And if you want to come over and take a look at the lab and see some of the students and faculty members and other research that's going on, please feel free to join us at any time.
I might take you up on that. I might bring my daughters.
Absolutely. They are more than welcome. We're doing this really for them. You know, I mean, this is not about, I had my time at the top of the rocket, if you want to use that metaphor, through a space career. And sort of as you get older, you move down the booster stack and you become the first stage. And your job is now to launch other people into space, regardless of where they're going. And now that we land those booster stages, instead of throw them away in the ocean, I feel much better about that, because I don't want to get thrown away in the ocean.
That was Ohio State Professor John Horak. He's the Neil Armstrong Chair in Aerospace Policy. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Anna. Appreciate it.
Coming up, we're talking Cards Against Humanity and why they're suing Elon Musk. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Today starts the 2 days of Amazon's Prime Day deals, but these bargains may not be all they're cracked up to be. Here to help us become smarter shoppers is Russell Holley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So Prime Day deals start today, but what should we as consumers know before we add to cart?
Yeah, so this is actually the second time this year that Amazon has done a great big shopping event like this. They called it Prime Day back in July, and this time they're calling it Prime Big Deal Days. But it really, it's the same basic format as Prime Day. And the whole deal here is that if you go on Amazon, there's just an enormous number of things that appear to be on sale. And like any shopping event, regardless of who the retailer is, not always exactly true that the thing is discounted as heavily as the website says. My big recommendation to everyone, there are two different websites you can use to confirm prices. One is a very silly named Camel, and the other is Keepa, spelled K-E-E-P-A. And both of them do basically the same thing. You take the link from Amazon, you drop it in there, and it will actually show you the price history so that you can see over the last 30 days, has it actually been the price that they say it is, or has it been jumping up and down in order to get people to make those purchases? What we have seen through all of the work that's been done so far at CNET is a lot of daily essentials are actually on pretty good prices. Stuff that you may not necessarily see on sale on a regular basis, like electric razors, toothbrushes, you know, just kind of household staples are actually on pretty big discounts. What we're not seeing are all of the like really great big things, like huge discounts on laptops and televisions and, you know, kind of grills and stuff like that. And the biggest reason for that is Black Friday is just over a month away, and it makes a lot of sense for those companies to kind of save those great big purchase discounts until later.
Yeah, that's what's going to be my next question is how does this compare to Black Friday, which is just around the corner? It's about 5 weeks away.
Yeah, it's really not that far away. And so what you're going to see is a lot of companies that don't make those great big, you know, kind of expensive things that most people only buy once or twice a year. You're not going to see huge discounts on those things, but that doesn't mean that there aren't things that are useful that are on pretty substantial discounts at this time. So, you know, I would keep an eye on stuff that you know that you use in the house, things like water filter replacements and stuff like that. A lot of that stuff you'll find is on pretty good discounts. Oddly enough, the one that struck out to me earlier today is Swiffer. If you are a Swiffer user, there is a ton of those that are on discounts, which is not a thing I normally end up saying.
What about Amazon's own products, like the Kindle, like their Fire tablets? Are they on discount or should we still be waiting for Black Friday?
That is a really good question, and I think it definitely depends on the kind of purchase you're planning on making. I would say that Black Friday is probably going to be, because, you know, if you are unaware, Black Friday has not been a single day in quite some time.
It is about a week. Oh my goodness, no.
You know, a lot of those things will end up fluctuating throughout the week. You will see, you know, starting immediately after most people are finished with their Thanksgiving meal is, you know, a ton of that stuff will go on sale that evening. And then it will continue through into a whole new wave of those things will go on sale on Monday. So it really just kind of depends on what your buying habit looks like. But yeah, I would say if you're planning on making a great big purchase to, you know, upgrade or improve something in your house, you probably want to wait a little bit for this one.
Let's talk about the Affordable Connectivity Program. In June, the program officially expired, and it was a program from the pandemic that helped families struggling to afford internet service, giving them about $30-ish dollars a month of a discount for internet service. So why is it coming to an end? I assume it's just because the pandemic is coming to an end.
No. So it actually came to an end already in June. Yeah. And, you know, so what we... The thing that we were kind of keeping an eye on was what was going to happen to existing prices that people were already paying in those areas. And what we have seen is if you were a part of CenturyLink or Quantum Fiber or Google's fiber service, which participated pretty heavily in this program, depending on where you were in the US. A lot of those people who were subscribed to those services, their contracts just switched to standard rates for whatever that area is, which in some cases can be two or even three times what they were paying for internet just 2 months ago, has now pretty dramatically increased. There are a couple of other carriers that are lesser known service providers in the US, like Brightspeed and a service called Kinetic, which is made by a company called Windstream, that are actually continuing that $30 a month service rate for folks who are on that plan, and they've more or less kind of grandparented them in for the foreseeable future for those services. But if you were part of one of the other services that switched back, there's not a ton of other options for you at the moment.
I know, just because, I mean, anybody who's set up cable and internet and all of that kind of stuff in their house knows that you sometimes only have one provider, sometimes you have two providers to choose from in your area.
That's exactly right. And that was one of the things, you know, Google Fiber had worked really hard to be competitive in this area because they had this government grant that allowed them to do so. And a lot of that has gone away. And it's not immediately clear what options would even be available to retain some of those prices. Depending on where you are in the U.S., there is a federal program called Lifeline. The federal Lifeline program offers, I think it's $9.50 or $10 a month, you know, for broadband in eligible households. And that price varies if you're on things like tribal lands or, you know, kind of more you know, kind of uniquely regulated areas. But anyone who was previously on the service, the recommendation from the government is to see if you apply for this Lifeline program. But the rules for what gets accepted is different state by state, so I can't give like a specific list of instructions there.
Yeah, a lot of it's just income based, and it can vary. And it obviously, it also depends on your family size. You know, when we were talking about the affordable connectivity program, it was for people making less than or equal to 200% of federal poverty, which is $62,000-ish for a family of four. So there are a lot of specifics, and you probably just need to look it up yourself.
Yeah, you definitely want to take a look. I know that there are a lot of resources that break down exactly how Lifeline works in your area. So I would take a look at that first. And, you know, also it's, you know, if the makeup of Congress were to change, it has been made clear that the Affordable Connectivity Program could come back. It's not like completely gone. It just currently does not have funding.
Yeah, but I am not going to get in the habit of trying to predict how the election will go.
That is probably the best choice for everyone right now.
So I wonder, and I don't know if we have any good data on it yet, how many people are just stopping service? Because doubling or tripling of your internet costs could be a reason somebody goes, you know, I just can't do it.
I suspect it's going to be a larger number than anybody would hope, especially given, you know, the importance of having a broadband connection in this day and age. But also, you know, it's entirely possible that a lot of folks had already started dropping that service before the program ended, because everything in a lot of these people's lives got more expensive over the last year. And so to know that your internet service was also tripling in cost, if you're already paying for a phone or you have a phone on some kind of discounted plan, that you may decide that that's all you need.
According to the White House, a large number of subscribers to this ACP were military families, and there were also higher rates among older Americans, African Americans, and Latinos. So we'll have to see if the program gets funding anytime soon. If not, unfortunately, I mean, you can try negotiating, you can try quitting, and maybe they'll give you that, like, please stay with us rate, but you never know.
That's right. And it's important to keep in mind that this service is very, very different from some of the kind of free offers that have been made available through companies like T-Mobile and Starlink for disaster relief, where the hardware is still required to be purchased, whereas through the ACP, the hardware was actually provided.
So I want to talk about Cards Against Humanity. For those who don't know, this is a card game that is, it's for adults. It can be a little dark in nature. It's funny. But the company is suing Elon Musk and SpaceX for allegedly trespassing on land that the card company owns by the southern border in Texas. Okay, that's a lot to kind of unpack. What's going on?
So the story actually gets far weirder, the kind of the deeper you look into this. If you're unfamiliar with Cards Against Humanity as a game, then you're definitely unfamiliar with the company, which over the last 10 years has done some pretty wild stunts in order to get some attention. A couple of elections ago, if you participated in one of their holiday, kind of purchase things where they quite frequently will say, give us $5 or $10, we will not tell you what it is for, and we're just going to send you a random gift at some point in the future. And one year, one of those gifts was every single contribution that your elected official had received from a third party that just, you know, was printed on what was essentially like a Costco receipt that just went miles and miles long in some cases. And, you know, sometimes it was something very political like that. Other times it was chocolate that was in a box that described itself as, you know, bull feces. Like there's a lot of different very silly things that this company has done. And one of those things was during the Trump administration, asking people to pitch in between $10 and $100 so that they could collectively buy a plot of land on the U.S. border. And this meant that a wall could not be erected in this place because it was being owned by this this group of individuals who decided that they did not want it to be there. And true to their word, a wall was not allowed to be built on that space. And it has remained largely unoccupied since then as this land that is just sort of owned by this card game company and all of the people who co-invested in it got a little thing that said that they owned a 1-inch by 1-inch, you know, plot of land in this town. Very, very silly thing that got done. But the reason that it has become a story recently is construction vehicles and other materials and gravel and things like that from the company SpaceX started arriving in this plot of land completely without the permission of the people who own it. Several requests were made to have this stuff removed from this plot of land, and they were immediately ignored, in which case the company who owns the land initiated a lawsuit against SpaceX and by that Elon Musk.
So SpaceX has property nearby and that it's using for its private program. So they were just kind of expanding their perimeter, essentially, or trying
to. Yeah, this is very much designated as a township if you were to look at it in a map. But if you were to drive there, there's just not a lot there. It's not like people live there. There's not a gas station or anything like that. It is just a plot of land. And because it was an empty plot of land, there was someone who made a decision at SpaceX that meant that it could be used for their purposes and not the original owner's intent.
Yeah, and this is where it gets sticky because the little bit I know about property rights law is that if you let that go on for years and years, usually, then there is the ownership becomes questionable.
That's exactly right. And that was something that, you know, this plot of land has actually been owned by the company, which, by the way, is based in Chicago. They're actually not based down in Texas. And so that company has to, you know, kind of declare that they have done something on that land every once in a while in order for the land rights to maintain. And so since 2017, they've been doing that, where they, you know, I think one year they live streamed from the property to show everyone, you know, basically the plot of dirt that was there. It was really not a lot on, you know, this bit
there
of land.
There might be some tumbleweeds, some sage.
That's exactly right. Yeah. But yeah, this was, you know, this was something that a collective, I believe the last time I checked the numbers, 150,000 people technically own bits of for this land, which there have been some legal minds who have questioned whether this could become a class action lawsuit as a result, because there are now not just a company that has an interest in this, but now there's suddenly a couple hundred thousand people who also have a claim in this. So it's likely that this story is going to continue to evolve in a very legal sense for the next couple of months.
Has SpaceX said anything in response?
Not really. The original quote that had come out was that the lawyer for SpaceX had said that this was something that they weren't unaware that they did not have permission for. But it was an incredibly vague statement, and nothing has been said since.
And as far as we know, they're continuing to use the property. So I guess it's going to be up to a court to decide what has to happen next.
That is exactly right.
And I don't think that Elon Musk has said anything about this lawsuit, at least as of yet. He's pretty prolific on X, but I don't think I've seen anything.
That's exactly right. No, he's been very busy doing other things for the time being, including if you go to X right now, there is a giant banner at the top of the page inviting you to register to vote, which is something that was there was something that had happened as a result of the previous owner's of that social media site, and it has continued to this election, which is not something that everyone suspected would be the case.
Yeah, that is interesting that they are doing that. I don't know. There's a lot. I mean, we could do a whole segment on Elon Musk and his different positions.
I feel like we could dedicate a whole week to that.
We have just a couple of quick seconds before the end here, but I wanted to just quickly ask you to weigh in on this lawsuit against TikTok for addicting teens. We got like 30 seconds. What is the quick summary of what's going on there?
I think it is the exact same kind of lawsuit that was levied against Instagram, and the Instagram lawsuit did not go anywhere at all. I think that because TikTok is in legal, kind of hot water in other places, that is, you know, kind of an interesting concept. But the same basic policy applies, is that you have to create an account and acknowledge, you know, kind of willful ownership of the things that you are doing. So it's extremely unlikely that they would be considered liable for addicting teens. I think the bigger issue there is that they tend to addict adults. I know a lot of adults who cannot stop swiping, whereas, you know, at the very least, my daughter can put it down anytime. That is incredibly anecdotal evidence, but that's kind of my thought there.
I'll take it. That was Russell Holly, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Thank you, as always.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.